listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Brunch with Bernie is going to be 2 hours from now, because Senator Sanders is on an airplane as we speak on his way to back to Burlington, Vermont. As soon as he gets there, he's going to hop in with us here. So it is currently 3 p.m. Eastern time. If you're listening to us live, he will be with us at 5 p.m. Eastern time. In other words, he'll be with us on our third hour, the third hour of our program. So just an FYI for those of you, I know a lot of people call in even before the show starts so that they'll have a chance to ask Bernie a question. So just let you know, 2 hours, just hang out. Meanwhile, this is also, you know, vitally important, and I am just so pleased that Lee Fong can join us to talk about this. Back when Citizens United was decided in 2010, Justice Stevens wrote in his dissenting opinion that, you know, this, by using the logic of the five votes in the majority on Citizens United, Tokyo Rose during World War II, she was the famous Japanese siren who was, you know, telling the U.S. soldiers to just give up and you're going to lose and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Tokyo Rose could contribute to U.S. political campaigns. I mean, she'd have free speech, free political speech in the United States. Well, it turns out that maybe not Tokyo Rose, maybe the 9/11 hijackers. I think 17 of them were Saudis, as I recall. Lee Fong would know. Lee Fong, literally one of the best investigative journalists working in this country right now, contributing writer to The Nation magazine, thenation.com. He's got a new article called Saudi-led oil lobby group financed 2012 dark money attack ads. Lee, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Tom. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, thanks for joining us. Tell us what you found. Let's just lay this thing out.
Well, you know, the Citizens United decision opened a significant loophole that kind of cleared the way for foreign influence in our elections. I mean, essentially, by taking away the rules that forced donations to political campaigns to come from individuals, instead allowing artificial creations of the law, corporations, either for-profit or non-profit, to spend unlimited amounts, that leaves the ability of foreign corporations, foreign agents, to influence our elections with no disclosure. And the way that this has already happened since 2010 when the decision was made is through trade associations, these multinational lobbying organizations that can now act like super PACs or campaign committees, except, again, with no disclosure. Many of these organizations were led by foreigners for many years. The only difference now is that they can spend in our campaigns.
So who is Tawfiq al-Ghabsani? Why should we care?
Tawfiq al-Ghabsani is a lobbyist, a foreign agent for the Saudi government.
He's registered with the U.S. government as a foreign agent representing the Saudi government, right?
That's right. He's registered with the Department of Justice. They have a registry of foreign agents, people who represent foreign governments here in the United States.
Right.
So he's registered there, but he's also an executive with the Saudi Arabian Oil Company, the state-run oil Goliath, one of the largest in the world. But what's interesting in the context of our election is that he's one of the board members of the American Petroleum Institute, the oil lobby group. And so the American Petroleum Institute for many years was prohibited from directly spending in American elections, but Citizens United changed that. So Mr. al-Ghabsani and his fellow board members have made the decision to start using their membership dues, their corporate money, which is composed of both American and foreign oil money, to basically shovel that money to groups that have run ads, in this case, pretty partisan ads, in favor of Republicans and against Democrats, all over the country. We have new disclosures showing that they're spending in 2011, they spent about $500,000 on groups that just pummeled Democrats, including President Obama, and promoted Republicans like Senator Scott Brown. Also, they did a lot of marketing in terms of, you know, supporting oil subsidies, attacking climate change, that sort of thing. But what's really a big marked shift that didn't happen before is that now that they can give really unlimited sums to groups that are engaging in very partisan electioneering activity.
So an official agent of the government that has historically, for example, published textbooks and sent them all around the world saying that Jews make holiday meal foods out of the blood of Arab children. Literally, you know, the Saudi government has subsidized this kind of thing. The country that sent us, was it 14 or 17 of the 9/11 hijackers? Do you remember the number, Lee?
I don't have the number on hand.
Yeah, but anyhow, the majority of the 9/11 hijackers, Saudi Arabia, which, you know, is theoretically an ally of ours, but it's a brutal dictatorship. It's a kingdom. This country, or an agent of this country, is taking this country and the royals, the Saudi royal family's money, and using it to buy our politicians, to promote, you know, to promote and some politicians in the United States and damage, discredit, or trash others. Am I saying that bluntly enough?
You know, the Saudi government has gone on record that they'd like to play a role in some of our legislative and policy debates. I mean, just 2 years ago, their representative at Copenhagen said we'd like to derail the climate change laws that President Obama tried to enact. I mean, there are obvious implications here. And again, this exact agent of the Saudi government is playing a big role because the American Petroleum Institute, they've had the largest sway over our climate and energy laws out of any other lobby group.
Now, when Citizens United was passed, and, you know, President Obama famously called it out in his State of the Union address, and Judge Sam Alito mouthed the words, not so, or something, it wasn't you lie. That was the other guy.
Not true.
Not true, yeah, thank you. You know, and there were a number of people on the right and the hard right, and, you know, who were, I had them on this program and on my TV program, who said, there's no possibility that foreign countries are going to be, you know, funding our elections. So, you know, you're not going to see that happen. You know, that would bring discredit to the candidates. They wouldn't want that to happen. We have a minute left. Is it playing out that way?
I would agree. I mean, if it was disclosed, I think that would actually hurt a candidate. But that's the rub here. I mean, I'm just finding some of these details now, and if you haven't noticed, the election's already over. If people knew about this during the course of the election, I think they would be apoplectic. But that's the nature of our campaigns now. It's all secret money. It's all undisclosed. The lobbyists and the foreign agents, they know where the money's coming from. But the American people, they have no clue.
Yeah. And somehow I'm guessing, given that the second largest stockholder of Fox News, of News Corp, is a Saudi prince, they're not going to be covering this story.
No.
Yeah. So this is quite remarkable. Although, you know, it could just as easily have been China or Vietnam or Mexico or Colombia or Canada. I mean, you
absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely. That's the loophole.
Yeah. Amazing. Lee Fong doing brilliant writing for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Check out his new piece, Saudi-led oil lobby group financed 2012 dark money attack. Yet we'll have a link over to Tom Hartman as well. Lee, thanks for being
with us
today.
Tom. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you. We will be back. We're gonna do Anything Goes Friday here, starting now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So Bernie will be here in an hour and 45 minutes. In between now and then, we'll be taking your calls on whatever's on your mind today. I've got a few things on my mind, too, actually.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows. Anything goes.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Keith in Bradford, Tennessee. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Love your program. Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you.
My question, or just a comment from you, was on corporations being a person and why we can't, you know, people can't use that to our advantage, such as, would that be considered stalking under stalking laws? And also, would that be considered, advertising, as the whole advertising market, as they profile people and then direct market to them, i.e. telemarketing and stuff? If a person is stalking another person, would that be considered stalking? And also, would the tax rates, if they are a person now, shouldn't they just be taxed at the same high rate as any other person of the United States or citizen?
Yeah.
Just a comment. I'll listen in. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Keith. I appreciate the call. What Keith is pointing out, and I'm assuming to a certain extent tongue in cheek, but is the bizarre nature of the Supreme Court's assertions going back to the 1880s that somehow corporations, that the personhood that corporations have, which allows them to sue and be sued, to pay taxes, to own property, things like that, which is entirely reasonable, viewing them as artificial persons, that personhood should be translated into the realm of natural persons, of human personhood, which is basically what Citizens United did, and to a certain extent. And it leads to all kinds of weird conundrums, like the ones that Keith just pointed out. There's others, for example, if you have a corporate merger with more than one partner, is that bigamy? Is that polygamy? Is it against the law? Is it same-sex marriage? What is the gender of a corporation? I don't know. If a corporation dies, do we have a funeral? Should we have a funeral for Hostess? I mean, they're going bankrupt. If a corporation buys another corporation, is that a violation of the 13th Amendment, which outlaws slavery? It outlaws the buying and selling of persons? And, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, there's all these obvious stupidities brought to us by five hard right cranks on the U.S. Supreme Court. And it looks like they're fixing to bring us a whole lot more stupidities as time goes on. Bill in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Tom, I'm wanting to make a comment about the newspaper article that shows that Obama's victory of margin keeps steadily growing.
Yeah, he's at or just about to hit 51% of the electorate, which the last time that happened, that a president got 51%, both being elected and then being reelected, was Dwight Eisenhower, who was a very popular president. And,
correct.
And so, I mean, you know, all these guys who want to worship Reagan all day long, or even Bill Clinton, Obama's, got him beat. And ironically, Mitt Romney, it looks like his percentage is 47% of the national vote.
Well,
I mean, that's like God talking to you, you know? I mean, it's like, go ahead.
Well, the one thing I wanted to comment on that was that everyone's want to, praise it because they're claiming that it's providing legitimacy to Obama's election.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wanting to point it out as a point of concern because, I mean, all these votes that were not counted, what if Romney had been close or even 50%? You know, would this have been another 2,000 when...
No, it wouldn't have been.
Bush
Obama was winning by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 points in various states. Yes, in Ohio right now, John Husted, the arguably criminal Secretary of State, at least criminal to democracy, is aggressively trying to throw out ballots, make sure the ballots aren't counted, particularly ballots from largely African-American areas or Democratic voting areas. This guy is one of the most partisan hacks. Yeah, I mean, you look up partisan hack in the dictionary, and there's John Husted's picture, right? It's a horror show. But if the ballots that have been thrown away and all the voter suppression that has happened hadn't happened, frankly, I think Obama's margin of victory would be 52 or 53%. Because the vast majority in the blue states, you don't see secretaries of state throwing out ballots aggressively. You don't see huge purges of voters going on, particularly in largely Democratic areas. in the red states or in the states where the state government is controlled by Republicans, those are the states, Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin. Those are the states, for example, among others, those are the states where you see Indiana, where you see the Secretary of State's office or election officials aggressively making it more difficult for people to vote, throwing people into provisional ballots, which are less likely to be counted, and knocking people off the voting rolls so they can't even vote to begin with. So no, I don't think that, to the extent that it's a cause for concern, thank you for the call, Bill. What concerns me is that 47% of Americans looked at a guy who is, you know, somewhere between a multimillionaire and a billionaire, who has gamed our tax system to become that rich. I mean, basically, that's all Bain Capital does, is they game the tax system. That's how it works. Buy a company, borrow the money to buy it, dump that debt on the company, take a huge tax write-off for it, have the company strip it down bare, very often offshore. Even if you kill a company, you still make a profit on it because you're gaming the tax system. And this guy who paid on an income of $20 million paid 14% income tax? Really? You want this guy as your president? I get it. Romney, there's 1% of Americans, or maybe 0.1% of Americans, who would rationally say, yeah, he's our guy because he represents our interests. But I would say probably even half of that 0.1% understand, good progressive values that this country was founded on when George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see America a more progressive nation. But just the fact that Mitt Romney even got 47% of the vote boggles my mind. I mean, 20% maybe? It's like, how gullible are we? 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the fact that Romney was able to, even in the debates, literally tell lie after lie after lie and largely get away with it, that boggles my mind.
All right. Express yourself. Express yourself.
Yes, indeed. It's Anything Goes Friday. And we have... Oh, there's an intro for this, isn't it? Or shall we play it as a bumper coming into the next segment? Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just wait until the next segment, and we'll get up with that. Elizabeth in Brookville, Ohio. Hey, Elizabeth, what's on your mind?
Hi. How are you today, Tom?
I am fine. You want me to explain why Obama should be our president?
I am saying why we should support our president.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And encourage Bernie when he comes on. To encourage other members of Congress, to encourage the general public to support President Obama in this, even
yep.
if it requires involving the cliff hanging over our economic cliff hanging over our heads.
Yeah, it's not really a cliff, Elizabeth. That's hyperbole. That's just flowery language that the Republicans have put together. We can go over the cliff, and it's not going to change very much. And the things that will hurt people, like cutting unemployment benefits, that's the principal one. That can be solved in a half hour in the first week or two after the beginning of the year, and nobody would even notice it. So
now that's true. But what I want to say, Tom, is that after Sandy, I noticed that crane hanging over New York, which was the Millionaires Club.
Mm-hmm.
Which I believe was a symbol from the Almighty, however we interpret it, to alert us to the enormous wealth that the upper 1% of Americans possess and how they use it compared to poor day-to-day existing Americans who are the other 99% of us and wonder whose interests should we try and protect
mm-hmm.
that 1% of the 99%.
That's very interesting, Elizabeth. You're right. The symbolism was quite extraordinary. Thank you so much for the call, and thanks
sure.
for watching Free Speech
uh-huh.
TV. Thank you. Michael in Batesville, Arkansas. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
I'm just since I started listening to you, I got a lot more intelligent about politics. I think you're a really smart man.
Thank you.
But what I think you ought to keep preaching to people is that we pay their salaries out of our taxes.
Right.
We pay their insurances out of our salaries. Most of us don't have near the insurance they got, and we got to pay for it too.
Yep.
You know, I'm all for universal health care, like Denmark's got there set up.
Mm-hmm.
And
every other developed country in the world, actually. We're the only one.
Yeah, right.
We're the only one that doesn't.
Basically, I wanted to come on and tell you that you're doing a great job, and I really appreciate it. And I've never heard more intelligible conversation about the idiots we got up there than from you.
Okay, Michael, thank you very much. It's much appreciated. Liz in North Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Liz, you're on the air. You want to talk about Dems calling tax cut for 100%?
Yes, I don't understand why no one says it's actually a tax cut for 100% rather than 98%, because everyone gets that, and only 2% would actually get a tax raise their taxes. So
yeah, and in fact, let me add to that: 100% of Americans who are earning wages that are high enough that they're paying federal income taxes will see. If President Obama's tax cut proposal is passed, we'll see a tax cut. Even the Warren Buffetts and Bill Gateses of the world, they will see a tax cut on their first $250,000 of income. They won't see a tax cut on the money they make above $250,000, but they will see a tax cut on the money they make below $250,000, just like everybody else. So you're absolutely right. It's a tax cut for 100% of us.
Yeah, so if Congress fails, nothing happens, then everyone will... It gives their taxes increase.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's very, very well said, Liz. Thank you very much for the call, Mike in Delano, Minnesota.
Oh, Delano, Minnesota.
Delano, gee.
Delano, right? Yeah, it's about 40 miles west of Minneapolis. I've been on your show a couple times and really enjoy watching your TV show and radio. I just have two quick questions. I've gotten through to some conservative pundits. In fact, one was. On your list last night on your TV show, that has a TV show on Fox, and it really makes their head explode when you bring up economic patriotism and things like that.
Yeah.
And when I debate them, you know, I bring up that Bill Gates started Microsoft when the tax rate was 70%.
74%,
so, yeah. It was a lot higher than what it is now. I said, do you mean to tell me that business entrepreneurs are looking at the tax rate when they start a business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's because they're saying it's going to hurt small business and business creation. But their comeback is, well, they weren't really paying 70%. So I got two quick questions for you. Do you know what the actual tax rate paid was when it was, you know, the tax rate was at 70 or 90%?
Yeah, 74 or 91%. Yeah, it would depend on the person. It would depend on what kind of deductions they could come up with. I don't know. You'd have to take a slice out, a tranche out. You'd have to say, okay, we're going to look at the top 1/100 of 1%, or the top 1%, or the top 0.1% or whatever. And I don't know that anybody's ever really done a good job of slicing and dicing those numbers. I'm not even sure that.
I saw Robert Reich on TV one time say it was about in the low 50s when it was 70.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if people, you know, depending on how much they took, ended up paying that. But I'm not sure that information. You know, for a long time, I'm trying to remember, I think it was during the Johnson administration, but I may well be wrong on that. But for a long time, all IRS information was confidential. And then Congress passed a rule, or the IRS changed a rule, one or the other, that allowed the aggregation of data on the top 100 or the top 400 or the top 1,000 wealthiest Americans. And just a very small number of people and the wealthiest corporations to be able to, you know, kind of look at what they are paying and publicize that. And that's a relatively recent thing. So I'm not sure that we even have numbers going way back.
Can I make one other quick comment?
Yeah, very, very quick.
When they were talking about, you know, the top 0.1% make all their money off capital gains.
Well, not all of it, but that's very common. Yes.
Right. And the capital gains tax would be eliminated under the Ryan's tax plan, which Romney said he would sign into law.
Right. It would take. It would have taken Mitt Romney's tax rates to zero.
Voted on that, and it would have been become would have become law. But they also, at the same time, through these negotiations, want to raise the retirement age by 2 years.
Right.
So I've been calling out some of these conservatives that I debate with about, well, you're, you know, the point I'm getting at is, make, you know, when they're concerned about our future, you know, the grandchildren and the children's debt, you know, what we're leaving the debt with, they're making people work longer to pay for tax rates for the rich, tax cuts to the rich.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, that is the Republican game, is transfer wealth from the middle class and the poor to the very, very rich, because the Republicans represent the very rich, the very, you know, I mean, basically the Republican Party was captured in the 1880s by the railroad barons, and then the 1890s by the banking and steel and oil guys, and they've been the party of big business ever since. And, you know, you've got this dynamic tension in America between the party of big business and the party of labor. And that's why the Democrats need to, you know, more consistently be the party of working people, because the Republicans have always consistently been the party of the top 1%. Mike, thank you for the call. Evelyn in and keep
yes,
up the great debate. Hey, Evelyn, in is it Isla Mirada, Florida?
Isla Mirada, Florida.
So what's up? You wanted to talk about the $250,000 cap?
Right. The $250,000 threshold for taxing or cutting taxes,
right,
is that on the adjusted gross income or the gross income? They've never really made it clear to most of us.
Yeah. I'm not sure that they're... Go ahead.
You can make a lot more money than $250,000 and have an adjusted gross income of $250,000.
You're right. You're right. And I don't know that that has been parsed out to the point where the specifics are on the table. So I've never seen an actual budget proposal or, you know, the specifics. President Obama has used that $250,000 number, you know, in 4 years, 5 years of campaigns now. And the Democrats have pushed that, and there have been a couple of different times.
I think they really need to make that differentiation, because in parts of the country, $250,000 is not that much.
Yeah.
But in most of the country, it is.
Yeah.
But the ones who are fussing the most about it are the ones who say, wait a minute, $250,000 is just too low.
Yeah. Well, if you're looking at $250,000 in taxable income, that's your adjusted net, right?
Yeah, that's your adjusted gross income, which normal taxes are figured on.
Right. So I'm guessing that would be the number, but, you know, the devil's in the details here.
Right. That's what I'd like to find.
We're going to have to wait until somebody actually produces some legislation to this effect. Although the Senate actually has passed a bill, you know, but all it does is it just ignores that top tax rate. So what we'd have to do is go back 10 years and see how it was implemented under the Clinton administration, because that's when this was actually written. And I'm sorry I can't do that off the top of my head, but maybe one of the folks in our chat room will be able to track it down, or somebody can let us know. Maybe somebody listening knows. Maybe there's a tax person out there who was doing taxes 10 years ago. How did it work back, you know, when under the Clinton years? Was it adjusted gross, or was it the gross income? Thank you, Evelyn. Excellent point. We'll be back with more Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And just a reminder that Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be an hour and 15 minutes from now. Bernie's on a plane. He's going to be in our third hour instead of our first.
Just hard to hang out with. He never shuts up.
Please leave a message with the tone.
You talk too much. You worry me to death.
Tom the Liar Hartman.
That sounds kind of crazy.
What you want to do is feed the government, take from the people, and give to the government so we can waste it. But that's the kind of guy that you are, Tom.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard.
Tom the Liar Hartman. You have this hatred, this passionate hatred for conservatives and for white people.
Sounds like you have mental problems.
They all talk, talk, talk.
Talk to you.
So thanks for listening, and thanks for watching.
Yeah, there you go. Welcome back. Yeah, we've got this comment line, and sometimes people who are afraid to call in and actually talk with me on the air call and leave pretty strange messages. There were pieces of it sliced into that of this one particular guy who just, you know, constantly calls and leaves these bizarre messages. Here's another one.
Tom, the liar Hartman, you know, you are just tax situation. 91%, and you know good darn well that nobody paid 91% during the Eisenhower years. That's just a lie, one of your many lies that you tell. You only tell half the truth, and there was a lot more deductions back in those days.
Well, there were a lot of deductions, and there was a 91% top tax rate, and I'm guessing probably a few people paid it, but most people didn't pay it because they didn't let their income go that high. And that's why, you know, during the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and up until the 80s, when the top tax rates were well above 50%, you did not have CEOs with, you know, five mansions and a castle in Switzerland and a private jet with gold-plated bathtub fittings. You know, we didn't have that. Mitt Romney's dad, George Romney, turned down a bonus. My recollection is it was a $100,000 bonus. Turned it down because he thought it would be unseemly when he was running American Motors. It's like, you know, CEOs, they were wealthy. They were doing okay, but they weren't dynastic like they are now. Right now, corporate profits are at an all-time high. The Mitt Romneys of the world are making more than, you know, anybody could. It's unimaginable how much money these people are making. I mean, the 400 people in the Fortune 400 wealthiest Americans, it's at the top 400, I believe, might be the top 100, have more wealth than the bottom 45% of Americans. The Walton family has more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans. It's just incredible. So, anyhow, Robert in Greer, South Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind? You want to talk about the government can't make money by exporting oil?
Yes, sir. I was concerned about these oil companies keep wanting the government to open up these federal land and get the oil out. Why don't the government be their own ambassador there and get the oil out of the ground and then sell it overseas? That could pay off our debts that we got against the
government. Well, that makes good sense. It's what Saudi Arabia did. It's what Iran did. It's what Hugo Chavez did down in Venezuela. It's, to a large extent, what Mexico did. A lot of countries have nationalized. It's what Norway did, and it's why Norway has one of the highest standards of living in the world and the highest literacy rate in the world. They nationalized the oil. They said if it's under the ground, it belongs to all of the people. And the government-owned oil company, or largely government-owned, depending on which country you're looking at, then, you know, sells that oil and uses the profit to build the country. I mean, it depends. You know, in the case of Saudi Arabia, they use the money for the royal family because it's a dictatorship. But you know, the democracies, they use it for the people. So I'm with you, Robert. I think it makes perfect sense, and I think that we should be nationalizing our oil. Up in Alaska, they actually took a step sort of in that direction. They tax the oil very heavily that comes out of the ground, and then they write a check. When Sarah Palin was governor, every year she wrote a check, averaged around $2,000 to everybody in Alaska. Hey, here's a check. It's your share of the, you know, the permanent fund. You know, it's not permanent, but of course the money that came, you know, it comes from the oil revenue. So yeah, we could do a lot of good with that. We should. Thank you, Robert. Dick in Billings, Montana. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Hey there. Hey, you know, I keep hearing all these so-called business guys crying about they're not going to hire people. I've been in business 33 years and have employed up to 50 people, and not one employee did I ever decide if I was going to hire or not because of my tax rates.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's the same here and same pretty much everywhere.
Well, why don't we do a better job getting small business people out talking on the circuit rather than these shills of the Republican Party that just lie, you know, when they breathe, it's a lie. I mean, it's crazy.
Here's the thing that concerns me. You've got these 81, I think it is, CEOs who have created this organization and this website that is, I think it's called fixthedebt.com, and it looks like a grassroots organization. It even has a donate button on it. You know, it makes it really look like this is a grassroots movement. And it's really some of the largest corporations in America. And what they're calling for is lower taxes on wealthy people, lower taxes on corporations, a permanent end to any U.S. taxation on corporate profits made overseas, raising the Social Security and Medicare retirement ages. And it's absolutely bizarre. They're getting all this press. They're getting all, you know, Lloyd Blankfein is one of them, the guy who's the CEO of Goldman Sachs. You know, he's all over the TV. He's all, you know, all they came to Washington, D.C. They're shaking hands. They're passing out money. I mean, they've gathered together $60 million to do this. And they've got this website that looks and ads. I saw an ad on one of the conservative websites this morning for this, you know, fixthedebt.com. They clicked on it through. And here's you know, Goldman Sachs CEO. I mean, this guy he's got more money than God. And he's saying, oh, well, you know, we have to accept the reality that people just can't take Social Security. It's just, you know, you can't raise that cap from $110,000 so that people like Lloyd Blankfein have to pay Social Security income tax or Social Security payroll tax on all of their income. I mean, you just can't do that. You know, this is an aristocracy after all. So I'm very concerned about the whole thing, Dick. I'm absolutely with you. You are brilliant and spot on. I've been an entrepreneur since the 70s, and I have never made a business decision based on personal taxation, with arguably one exception, but that's such a wild exception that it probably proves the rule. Dick, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. By the way, Republicans, 5 overreactions. This is from the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. 5 overreactions to Obama's fiscal cliff proposal. Charles Krauthammer, it's worse than surrender in the civil... Lee, you got better terms at Appomattox. Right. And he lost the Civil War, says Krauthammer. Kimberly Strassel, the Wall Street Journal column, it's something out of Wonderland and Oz combined. Eric Erickson, of course, nothing good can come out of negotiating further. By the way, he has said he's not going to challenge Saxby-Chambliss. I don't think it's because, we played that montage of his outrageous statements on the air. I think it's because he originally was playing with the idea of challenging him just as a way of getting in the press. So, you get S.E. Cupp doing the same thing right now, going, no, I'm not going to run for mayor in New York City. Well, who said you should? Okay. And Joe Scarborough, I'd walk out. And then Tucker Carlson, he goes through this long thing about how, you know, going over the fiscal cliff, it's going to shock the economy. It'd be terrible. And then he says, dive headlong off the cliff. Right. Well, you know, if you can't have it your way, then crash the entire economy. This is the Republican mantra. It's what they did last year when they downgraded our credit rating by refusing to raise the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling, by the way, is not something that the founders put in the Constitution or anything like that. The debt ceiling was passed in the 1950s during the Eisenhower administration. It was something that was pushed by Republicans and some, you know, fiscally conservative Democrats. Democrats controlled the House of Representatives throughout that era. And, basically the you know, it was an attempt to, it was an attempt to try to say we want to be fiscally sane. You know, we want to be rational. We want to have, you know, try and work toward a balanced budget, pay our bills, all that kind of thing. But I don't think that when it was passed, the Republicans who pushed for this had in mind the kind of warfare, trench warfare weapon that the deficit ceiling has been used as over the last 4 years by Republicans in the House of Representatives in particular. I don't think they had any clue on that. So, but in any case, it's Anything Goes Friday. So, Archie, you want to talk about Alan Grayson's tax ideas?
Oh, Tom, yes. Let me rant. It's so elegantly simple. I just loved it. Tax a dollar as a dollar.
Yep.
A percentage, it's percentage to Medicare. It's percentage to Social Security. I mean, right to the top. And a little addendum. If you make more than $10,000, let's
raise it to 50%. I know they'd love to do it because we got a storm across this country going on. We all are helping out with Sandy. We did for Katrina. And also, get Chano, I think his name is, all the Reagan clips so we can teach our Republican friends about taxes and earnings and fairness. Reagan spoke about it so many times.
I know.
Thanks, Tom. I love all the 99% of your brilliant callers.
Well, thank you, Archie. I appreciate the call. Thanks for watching in Yucca Valley, California there. Yeah, well, I guess that just kind of stands alone. It doesn't require a comment. Well, actually, I do want to make a comment. Alan Grayson said, and he said this on our show on Monday, as I recall, he said, I said, what's your solution? He said, let a dollar be a dollar. Now, you say, well, isn't a dollar a dollar? Well, no, not according to the tax code. The first $110,000 that you earn, every one of those dollars gets taxed for Social Security. But somehow, if a person earns over $110,000, then their dollars aren't dollars anymore. They're magic dollars. And they're not subject to Social Security taxation anymore. Does that make any sense to you? Doesn't make any sense to me. If you have, you know, if you earn a good income, you earn over, you know, roughly $360,000, $400,000 a year, you pay 36%, 35% income tax. Unless on each one of those dollars, or not each one of those dollars, on every dollar over that amount. Your first $10,000, $15,000, you don't pay any taxes on. But, you know, because it's a graduated income tax. But oddly enough, let's say you make $1 million. Okay, on the second half of that million, you're going to pay 35% income tax. Unless those dollars were earned by investment. If they were earned by investment, then a dollar's not a dollar. It's like a quarter of a dollar or something, because you pay a maximum 25%. Actually, right now you pay a maximum 15% income tax on it. It's going to go up to 20% if we go back to the Clinton tax rates. And, you know, historically it's been in the range of around 25% capital gains. But it's always, almost always, it was 1 year during the Reagan administration when capital gains and ordinary income were equalized. So, you know, let a dollar be a dollar. It's just as our caller said, it is just common sense. And Alan Grayson is brilliant in saying it. Judy in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Hey, Judy, you are a tax person with an answer to our question about gross and adjusted?
Yeah.
How cool
I don't
is that?
Have the books going back past 2006, but mm-hmm. your tax rates are based on your taxable income, not your AGI. Your AGI is adding up all your income from various sources, such as earned income, interest, dividends, pensions.
Right.
Social
now,
security,
let me just
take off.
Let me just, if I may, just I'm not all that smart about this stuff. I don't have a million sources of income, and it's not, you know, my income is pretty straightforward. I get a paycheck, and you know the people who write it take the service that we use takes the taxes out of it. So,
right.
So the adjusted gross income, that's the AGI. That
AGI,
is
right. That's the bottom line on the front page of the 1040.
Right. So that's
you add up all your sources of income, mm-hmm. and then at the bottom half of it, there's adjustments such as self-employed insurance,
right.
50% of self-employment tax, educator expenses, etc.
Right.
That carries forward to the top line of page 2 of the 1040.
Right.
And then you take off your either standard or itemized deductions and personal exemptions, and that brings up your net taxable income. That's the rate. That's the amount that the tax rate is calculated on.
Okay, so somebody could earn $300,000, $400,000, and if they had enough
right.
deductions to get them down to $250,000, they would not be paying that top 39.6% that it's going to go to.
Right. A lot of people's misconception is they're thinking of gross income, but that your gross is not what's taxed.
Okay.
And then if you've got capital gains or dividends or whatever, a portion of that in your taxable income is going to be at 15% or less.
Right.
I actually did some test scenarios a while back because I have IRS software.
Mm-hmm.
And I plugged in like $1 million, $2 million, $100,000, various, and I plugged it in as interest or dividends or whatever.
Right.
And it was astounding.
How much you can save if your income is from, you know, like Paris Hilton's and Mitt Romney's from passive investments?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
I plugged in some figures, and I wasn't even taking deductions. I was just doing some basic scenarios if they just took standard deductions.
So when Mitt Romney has...
Just to come up to see what the percentage is.
Yeah, so when Mitt Romney has $20 million in income, then he knocks off the cost of his horse. That's deductible. Right. So that.
Right. Your, well, even your cost is subject to 2% of your gross if you itemize, if your cost of tax preparation. So
uh-huh.
I imagine they pay a pretty hefty sum.
Yeah, but that's even deductible.
Yeah, your health insurance as part of your medical expense and all that. If you can get up to over 7.5% of your AGI.
Judy, God bless you. Thank you. Thank you for being a smart person, listening to our program, and calling in. I appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners and viewers on earth, and I really appreciate it, because every now and then there'll be a holder where I don't know what I'm talking about. Somebody will call up, and they know.
Olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something.
Oh, that's the Kennedy Center, isn't it? Yeah. How cool is that? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Anything Goes Friday. Just a quick, you know, programming note. Senator Sanders will hopefully, you know, assuming his plane is on time. I don't know. Has anybody heard? We have. It's going to be close, but in all probability, he will be here with us 40 minutes from now at the top of the next hour for our one-hour brunch with Bernie. So, Hoden in Loganville, Georgia. Hey, Hoden, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's nice talking to you. I actually had an idea. I initially wanted to call in and thank Senator Sanders because I had called in a couple weeks ago right after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been good on his word, and I've seen him. I've been paying close attention, and I've gone to my local congressman and my local senator's offices and told them not to cut the vital services that Americans need. And I've been paying attention to him, and he's been doing such a good job, and he's worked so hard to take Social Security off the table for now. So that was my first comment. And my second comment is I heard a gentleman call in earlier about, you know, the homeless not being cared about in this country and, you know, kind of being ignored in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I live in, you know, in a small community in Georgia. I live in Loganville, Georgia, and it's a suburban area, and we've never had homeless people. But after the recession, we're starting to see a lot of homeless people,
oh,
not
my.
Just in the urban areas, but coming out.
Yeah.
And I lived in Canada for 10 years, and it was amazing. I had a personal experience with a family member that ran away when they were young and ended up in the wrong side of town just because she was upset with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was she called a number that she saw. Social workers picked her up, helped her after she was hurt, and brought her to her family. She was unharmed, and they have so much social services like that in Canada.
Yes, they do.
And they don't have a police state like we have here. They don't have an army like we have here. And the Republicans and conservatives complain about basically, you know, they want to have guns because they don't trust the government. Well, then why do they want a bloated military?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that is one of those bizarre contradictions. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
We spend about 22% of our GDP is government spending. In Canada, it's in the high 40s. I think it's 47%, but it's in that neighborhood. And the Canadians actually get a lot for that. And most European countries, it's over 50%. They get a lot for it. And they get a very good quality of life for it. And anybody who's spent any time in Canada knows what I'm talking about. So, Hoden, thank you very much. An excellent point. Thank you for the call. William in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, William, what's on your mind? You want to talk about mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices?
Yes, I was wondering, since they've inserted themselves so much into everyone's lifestyle anymore, what what would be involved in doing that, setting a mandatory retirement age for a Supreme Court justices?
It would take an act of Congress. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution specifically says that the standards by which the Supreme Court operates shall be regulated by Congress. I'll read you the exact language. And in that, the court and shall operate under such regulations as the Congress shall make. So there is an example of a president who tried to put a retirement age on members of the Supreme Court and using Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution as the basis for that. And that was Franklin Roosevelt in 1937 after he won the election in 1936. As he started in 1937, the first thing he did out of the box, or one of the very first things, was he had nine guys on the Supreme Court who kept knocking down New Deal programs and saying that they were unconstitutional violations of the right to private contract. And they had said, you know, over the last few decades, things like child labor laws were violations of the right to private contract and you know, laws protecting unions and you know, it just went on and on and on. So about half of the Supreme Court at that point was older than 70 years old. So Roosevelt proposed a law that would say that any member of the Supreme Court over 70 years old becomes a member emeritus. They still sit there. They still listen to the arguments. They still participate in the conversations. But however many they are, in aggregate, they have one vote. So if there are five guys who are over 70 on the Supreme Court, that becomes one vote. And it opens up four seats. And that would, and in fact, at the time, I think it would have done exactly that. My recollection is that what was called Roosevelt's court packing scheme would have put 13 people on the Supreme Court because he had five people who were over 70 on the court at that time, as we do now. And there, I read a book on this last year that was a really good history of that time. I mean, it was a good history of the Roosevelt administration, but the focus of the book was Roosevelt's court packing scheme. And the story that we're told by most, you know, kind of armchair history books is that, you know, the history books that deal with it in a few paragraphs or a page or two, is that Roosevelt tried it, he failed, he got a black eye out of it, and he backed away. But what really happened was, one, he tried it. Two, all of a sudden the Supreme Court started ruling differently. And they started ruling in favor of his New Deal. In other words, he changed their behavior. There was no new members to the Supreme Court. He actually changed their behavior. And three, he withdrew the effort to push this thing through. And in fact, it's like I said, it's been a year, maybe two since I read the book, so I don't have the title and author right at the top of my head. But this guy built a compelling case. I mean, literally going through the members of the House and Senate and how they would have voted on this, that had Roosevelt pushed this, he actually could have gotten it passed. And I think probably he should have, because, you know, bringing new blood onto the court seems to me like a good thing from time to time. So on the other hand, then Reagan might have been able to do the same thing and make the court even more radical right wing. So, you know, it's who knows?
Okay. Well, there,
answer your question. Yeah. William,
we're kind of lost at any, I guess, any way to adjust the outcomes of the Supreme Court since they said
we've got. Yeah. According to the Supreme Court, the only way you can adjust the outcome of a Supreme Court decision is by either writing new laws that conform with that decision or passing a constitutional amendment. That's why you need to go to movetoamend.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I believe it's seven of the amendments to the U.S. Constitution were passed in less than a year. If the will of the people is there, we can amend the Constitution.
Stone for Christmas. You,
I'll be stoned for Christmas. Oh, it's for Colorado, of course, in Washington State. Yeah, this is interesting. Now, Hillary Clinton was asked about this last night, and somebody in some venue, I just caught a piece of the news story earlier today. And she said, you know, they asked, do you think that this is going to solve the problem of drug lords and things like that? And she said, personally, I don't think so, but I respect the opinion of the many Latin American leaders who believe that it will, which I thought was a very diplomatic way of saying, I can't tell you that I think that it does, but it probably does. In my opinion, I don't know. And but apropos of the Christmas music, President Obama, of course, you know, there's this whole hysterical thing. Obama won the election because he was Santa Claus, as Rush Limbaugh was wont to say over and over and over again. Well, just I'd say, yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, the Democrats have always been Santa Claus. They have said, now, you keep in mind, you have to leave out the cookies and milk for Santa. Right. In other words, you have to pay for this stuff. We pay Social Security taxes for the Social Security. We pay Medicare taxes for the Medicare. We pay unemployment taxes for the unemployment. We pay all kinds of, we pay taxes that are used, that are used to give oil companies oil depletion allowances and tax loopholes. We pay taxes to pay for the Fifth Fleet to protect the shipping lanes so that the oil companies can sell us gasoline at inflated prices. I mean, we pay taxes on everything, right? So we're willing to pay for it, but we would like it. So my guess is that the essence of probably Limbaugh's show today and maybe some of the other right wingers is going to be off this little story. This is in the Los Angeles Times. President Obama heads to a toy factory in Pennsylvania on Friday with a Christmastime message for Republicans. Extend the middle class tax cuts or risk hurting businesses such as the Roden Group, the maker of Tinker Toy and Angry Birds building sets. So he's going to a toy factory. Now, who goes to a toy factory? Santa, of course. Ho, 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 Jim says. Yes. All right. So anyway, but I think it's, like I said, what the Republicans are trying to do is they're trying to force the Democrats to shoot Santa. And the Democrats have to say, no, we're putting the gun down. No more ending welfare as you know it. No more, no more cutting off benefits for people. No more, we are not going to shoot Santa Claus. Santa Claus was the invention of the Democratic Party. Helping people, giving people bootstraps that they can pull themselves up by. My wife Louise, her father would not have been the assistant AG, Attorney General of the state of Michigan, had it not been for a Democratic Santa Claus called the GI Bill. That said, if you served your country, when you come back, you can go all the way to law school. First guy in his family ever to graduate from college. I mean, it's just like, yeah. And the Republicans, they've always been Scrooge. They've always said, no, 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 you can't have that either. No. Wait a minute. Some rich guy's going to have to pay some more taxes. What? No, we're all paying taxes for this. We're all willing to pay for it. John in Alexandria, Pennsylvania. Hey, John. Grover Norquist?
Yes, Tom. Thank you for the great work that you do. And I just want to say, I called my representative in Washington today, Representative Glenn Thompson, okay?
Who is of what party?
Yeah, of course, he's a Republican.
Okay.
This is Lily White, Central Pennsylvania, where they vote Republican, even though they have the second lowest per capita income in the state.
Right.
Which, guess that one.
Yeah.
But I asked him if Grover Norquist was one of his constituents. And, of course, the phone goes click.
Really? They hung up on you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do all the time. I'm going to be that man's worst nightmare. I used to have the Schuster as my representative, who I've always referred to as Shyster, because they're criminals, basically. But, an example with me. I have MS. I have a Republican governor came in and cut what little help that I had for the $70,000 in medical costs. And now I get none.
Wow.
And it's ridiculous. But yet we can hand out, people like Mitt only paying 15%.
Right.
But, they didn't lose the election because the president was Santa Claus. They lost the election because the American people were finally starting to wake up.
Yeah. Well, and it's because the American people realized that our government was created by people who fought and died to create
That's
a government
right.
that would promote the general welfare, as it says in the preamble to the Constitution, and as it says in the specific authorization of Congress to raise taxes and spend money in Article 1, Section 8, to promote the general welfare.
Another comment I have for you, Tom. I work at Penn State University, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I asked a political science
professor this one to ask to his students. Why did the religious right flock to a president who had 666 in his name, Ronald Wilson Reagan?
Right.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I remember back when Reagan was president and there was all this speculation. You know, his original home address was 666. They actually changed the number of his house because he lived at a house that was 666. And but there was all this.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was all this weird speculation that in the Revelation story, there's these two players. There's the whore and the beast, and the whore is the one who has the mark of the beast on her forehead, and then the beast is the one whose name is a number, and the number is 666. And Ronald Wilson Reagan each has six letters in it, and Gorbachev had this birthmark that looked like a horn on his forehead, and it had some of the evangelicals pretty had their panties in a wad there for a while back in the mid 80s, but I think Ronald Reagan deep down inside was actually a decent man. In fact, there's no doubt in my mind that deep down inside Ronald Reagan was a decent man. I've read his son's biography of him. I know Ron Reagan, his son, somewhat. And you look at when Reagan was a Democrat, and he was a passionate Democrat. And said
yes,
some
I realize that.
Yeah, and said some really good things.
One of the devil's party.
Yeah, I think he just got sucked in, and then toward the end of his presidency, I think Alzheimer's got him. But we need to kind of cut him a little bit of slack and say, okay, time to move forward. But John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Aurelio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on 1350 AM. Am I saying that right, Aurelio?
Yes, I've talked to you before. Thank you for taking my call. The people in New Mexico love your show, appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I have a question. The cap, Social Security cap,
mm-hmm.
It's $110,000 if I'm not mistaken.
So, yeah, it's $110,000.
Tweaking the Social Security, not problem. Why can't they erase that or completely take the cap off?
They could easily do that. All it would take is a majority of the members of the House of Representatives and 60 members of the United States Senate, given the current filibuster rules. And they could simply say, and this is what President Obama has proposed, is even leave a donut hole in there between $110,000 and $250,000 where people don't pay any Social Security tax, which seems kind of dumb to me, but you could do it. And just say all income above $250,000 is, as Alan Grayson says, a dollar is a dollar. It is subject to taxation the same way the first $110,000 is. And that would solve the Social Security problem in one fell swoop, end of discussion, period, forever.
Right. Well, yeah, I agree totally. Remember, Ronald Reagan started borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund.
Well, Ronald Reagan actually created the Social Security Trust Fund, and this is where he deserves some credit. Reagan actually in 81, he made Social Security income taxable, and there's a lot of things that didn't work out all that well, but in that giant compromise, but they saw, with the I think Daniel Patrick Moynihan was on that commission, and there was somebody else, but in any case, Alan Greenspan, it was Greenspan and Moynihan. And they put this thing together where they said, there's this demographic bulge coming through here, this rabbit going through the python, which is the boomer generation. And when these boomers, were born after World War II, when they started hitting retirement age in the 2000, 2010, 2020, in that era, then, Social Security is not going to be able, people working, the ratio of workers to people on Social Security is going to change so much that you won't have enough workers to provide for the Social Security. So we're going to have that generation starting in 1981, or maybe it was 82, we're going to have that generation double taxed. They're going to not only pay for their parents' retirement, which is how Social Security has been running since 1935, they're also going to pay for their own retirement in advance. And so starting in 1982, the boomers, well, everybody actually, but it largely hit the boomers, from 82 until today and into the future, I think around 2030, 2040, there's this Social Security trust fund that was created, and that's this giant savings account where the boomers taxed themselves to pay for their own retirement so that, you know, they wouldn't crash Social Security. And it was a arguably inelegant solution, but it was a solution. And at least they took it on, which is, I think, you know, in retrospect, a good thing. So, Aurelio, thanks for the call. But I'm totally with you. It's time to say, as Alan Grayson says, a dollar is a dollar. Whether it's your first dollar, your 110th dollar, your 110,000th dollar, your 220 millionth dollar, Mitt Romney, a dollar is a dollar, and you pay Social Security taxes on every single one of them. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday, and Senator Sanders will be with us in 15 minutes. So stick around for Brunch with Bernie.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Ain't that news?
Yeah, let's check out the news with Victoria Jones. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition to ask President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman. Wouldn't that be a marvelous Christmas gift? At free-don.org. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, President Obama went to a toy factory today.
What? Because he's Santa Claus. Didn't you get the memo from Limbaugh?
That's right. He's Santa Claus. He gave all those gifts.
There you go.
So he went, and because this factory, according to the president, is going to be in for seeing an increase in its taxes and its expenses if we go off the fiscal cliff at the beginning of January. And he said, at a Roden Greek plant where more than 95% of the parts for Kanex construction toys are made, everybody here, you'll see your taxes go up on January the 1st. I'm assuming that doesn't sound too good for you. That's sort of like the lump of coal you get for Christmas. That's a Scrooge Christmas. And he said that House Republicans can prevent that fate. He did say, I've been keeping my own naughty and nice list for Washington, so you should keep your eye on who gets some Kanex this year. There are going to be some members of Congress who get them and some who don't. John Boehner, the Speaker, wasn't in the mood for jokes. There's a stalemate. Let's not kid ourselves, the Speaker said. He's dismissed the White House's current opening offer on the talk, saying it wasn't serious.
Yeah, in other words, how dare you say that you want to raise taxes on rich people? Rich people pay for John Boehner's lifestyle.
Right, and
campaigns,
how dare you make such an opening bid that is so opening and so
specific
high and so bold?
Yeah,
that you didn't cave in the opening bid. Which
yeah,
I think many expect him to do.
We'll see if this, you know, if this is the point that he's going to negotiate halfway down from, I'd be a little disappointed. But if he holds firm on this, we have a new Obama.
Well, he'll negotiate down. I mean, I don't think anybody expects he's going to get $1.6 trillion in tax increases. He's probably going to get something. He hopes probably to get about $1 trillion.
Yeah, but still. I mean, that ain't bad.
Not bad at all.
Yeah.
You know, from his point of view. And spending cuts, he asked for $4 billion in spending cuts. It's not going to be that. It's going to be considerably more than that. He knows that. I mean, it's an opening bid. It's like buying a rug.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, been there, done that. In Egypt, in fact.
The Republicans are acting like they never have, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
But we'll see. We've got a while to go before December the 21st, which is when everybody hopes to get this thing done. And, of course, we'll be scrambling by then because we probably won't.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, I think everybody knows it's going to happen after the first of the year.
Yep, very likely, very likely. A federal appeals court today in Chicago heard arguments in a case that challenges whether President Obama had the authority to appoint three people to the National Labor Relations Board without Senate approval. You remember this?
Mm-hmm.
And also who gets to decide whether the Senate is in session.
Hmm.
This is the three NLRB appointments that the president made in January under a provision for filling vacancies when Congress is in recess. The Senate had taken off for a 20-day recess, and Republican leaders and right-to-work groups said it technically stayed in session because it was gaveled in and out.
Mm.
And so the appointments were unconstitutional, and the Obama lawyers argued the Senate called for a recess, so no business was conducted.
So this is being heard by whom?
The 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals today.
Woo-hoo. Well, this would be interesting, because they'll whatever they do, it's going to get kicked up to SCOTUS, to the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. They heard the arguments today. The National Right to Work Legal Defense Fund said the Senate has the power to make its own rules. The Obama administration, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General, said that the Senate called the recess, said no business would be conducted, and didn't require senators to attend the brief session, some of which lasted less than a minute. So it was taken under advisement, but legal experts say the outcome is uncertain because there's little precedent, and as you just said, it's expected to wind up before the Supreme Court sometime next year.
This will be fascinating.
Very interesting. Also today, the House approved legislation aimed at providing more visas to foreign nationals with advanced degrees from U.S. universities, degrees in science, technology, engineering, and math.
Now, this is the Republicans' effort to say, yes, we like immigrants. And it seems to me like they're shooting themselves in the foot, because first of all, what this bill does is it reduces the total number of immigrants that can come into the country. And secondly, what it does is it says the people that we're going to embrace are the people who are the graduates of the high-end schools who came here from other countries to go to those schools. We want to keep them here. But I get calls all the time from people who are literally, I mean, I had a guy day before yesterday who literally was a rocket scientist and unemployed. From engineers who are unemployed, people who are, so it's, I think it's going to have the net effect of driving down wages at the top end, you know, of these highly skilled employment areas. And it's just, I think it's, this is going to end up being a ham-handed move by the Republicans in supporting this.
Well, the White House has opposed it because it eliminates the visa diversity program, which gives countries with low rates of immigration to the U.S. access to 55,000 visas. So those will disappear. Many of those visas are used by African countries.
Right.
And in fact, racism was called by Representative Hank Johnson of Georgia, who said the visa program raises the ugly head of racism. He said if it's not racist in intent, then it certainly is in its effect.
Yeah.
But it's going nowhere. The White House opposes it. It's not going to get anywhere in the Senate.
Okay. Interesting.
So it's it's just one of those.
But this
things.
Is but this is where the Republicans have put their flag in the sand, with or at least some of them, you know, with regard to immigration.
Exactly.
It ain't the Dream Act.
It ain't the Dream Act. No, it's a start.
Yes. Okay, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a nice weekend.
You have a wonderful weekend too. I really appreciate your newscasts. And this, of course, is brought to you by free-don.org, the petition to ask President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman, free-don.org. Coming up next, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be with us for our national town hall meeting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie is on his way. He is in a car careening through the alleyways of Burlington on the way to the studio right now. So he will be with us shortly for Brunch with Bernie. And in the meantime, I will take a couple of calls. Tom in Seattle, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Whoa, Tom. Hey, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about the filibuster?
I do.
So go for it.
Tom?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
My concern is that when people start filibustering, they're not going to be reading out of the phone book. They'll be reading talking points developed by the right-wing foundations and corporations. So I believe they already have talking points ready to do this. So they'll be 24/7 on C-SPAN, giving people lessons on right-wing ideology and economic philosophy. Now, I'd like Bernie, if he could, to be sure that people, as they filibuster read things that they have personally written.
Yeah. Okay. Tom, your cell phone's breaking up, but I get your point. And that's actually a good one. That's kind of the law of unintended consequences. If you force a filibuster, if you force them to speak long, they will speak long using Fox News right-wing talking points, and that will work its way into the media. Could be. Or it could be that people will just ignore them. I mean, after the novelty wears off, you know, there's going to be a few, but after the novelty wears off. Reginald in Houston, Texas. Reginald, what's on your mind? You want to talk about the fiscal?
A lot of things on my mind, but this is what I want to figure out. Yeah, a couple of times I've been in a financial tight, and I had some CDs. And because I was in a tight, I went and cashed those CDs in. Mm-hmm. The point I'm making is that if we're in a fiscal cliff, and you're putting Medicare and Social Security and Medicare on the table, why wouldn't we be able to cash in those treasury bills that are owed to Social Security to be able to get ourselves out of this bind, you know, at least cash in some of them to balance us out? I believe that those treasury bills are not as solvent as we say. Well, if we go to cash them in, we're going to get a blank check because they're trying to act like that money is not there so that we can take from somewhere else instead of using our reserve. So is that reserve a reserve or is just some phantom deal that's out there with those old treasury bills?
A little bit of all of the above. First of all, let's just go through these one at a time. First of all, there is no problem with the debt. At least so far. Right now, our debt is costing us a couple $100 billion a year in interest, and that's about it. So the debt is it's there. It's larger than it should be. Reagan started this, you know, three consecutive Republican presidents jacked it up as hard and as fast as they could. And, so that they could scream when Democrats came into office that the Democrats needed to shoot Santa Claus. But, you know, there it is. But it is not creating a crisis for the United States at all. In fact, our debt compared with the debt of other nations around the world is relatively modest. So, it's not a problem. But if you wanted to do something about it, B, you wouldn't want Social Security to cash in the $2.7 trillion that they have in Treasury bills, because that's debt that the government owes itself. So really, you shouldn't even consider that as part of the national debt. And, you know, that's money the government owes itself.
Tom,
and then
so the treasury bill is insignificant, you know, that we can't use that to do, you know, so if we're saying it's there for security, it's like security on a debt. So that means we'll never be able to use it.
Treasury bills, you know, they're like your CDs. You know, you cash them in and you get the money. When Social Security starts to see right now, Social Security is bringing in more money. Actually, they're probably right around the tipping point where they start spending out more than they bring in. And that's the point at which they start spending down that trust fund. And it was established to be spent down. It was created in 1982, the trust fund. There didn't used to be a Social Security trust fund. Social Security always used to be, you know, last in, first out accounting, I think it was, or whatever it's called, LIFO or FIFO. But it always used to be basically the people working today pay into Social Security enough money that will pay for all the retired people who are on Social Security. And in 1982, they, you know, the Greenspan Moynihan Commission said, you know, what are we going to do about the baby boomers? And so they said, well, let's double tax them and put that money in a savings account so that when they retire, they will be able to live off Social Security that they themselves paid into, as well as paying for their parents' retirement. So Social Security taxes doubled in the first or second year of the Reagan administration as a consequence of this. And for one generation, the boomers are going to be, you know, they're going to pay this double tax. So that money is supposed to be spent. So that's not the crisis. And the third point I'd make is if you are concerned about the national debt, the Treasury, now this is, some people say this is a cockamamie idea, but I have not found anybody who can punch a hole in it. And actually several reasonable, you know, economists that, and economic writers that I have a lot of respect for, people like Ellen Brown, have actually said, you know, this could easily be done. The Constitution says that the Treasury can mint coins. And right now we've delegated to the Federal Reserve most of the creation of our currency. When we, you know, need more money, the Federal Reserve prints it, in quotes. I mean, you know, it's printed on computer screens, but basically the Federal Reserve creates that money. And that's money basically that we owe back to the Federal Reserve. So there's like, you know, the Federal Reserve is a separate thing. But if the government itself creates money, it has to do it by making a coin. So if you look at what's in your pocket, if you've got any change in your pocket in addition to some folding paper, that folding paper is Federal Reserve money. The coins are actual Treasury Department money. So your coins are actual real money made by the United States government. So if the U.S. Mint made 6 or 8 or 10 $1 trillion coins and then used and then took those coins out of the U.S. Mint and gave them to the Treasury Department and said, this is to pay down the debt, you know, we're going to redeem, you know, the debt, the debt would be retired. And the, you know, the danger in that is that it might be inflationary. In fact, it almost certainly would be over time. But
so you're saying, Tom, is that if we call in that Treasury note, just like China called in some of the, you know, Treasury notes, say about, can America, can she cover that? If we call in some of those Treasury notes and we wanted that, could she cover that?
Yeah.
You know, in gold or whatever her assets is to cover that, or would she go be insolvent? Well, she couldn't cover her Treasury notes.
The United States is the richest country in the world. We have enormous resources.
Really?
We have been living on a rice and beans diet since the Reagan administration, since they started this thing called Starve the Beast. Remember that? Remember this was Reagan's idea. David Stockman, I think, named it Starve the Beast. It's Reaganomics. And it's basically, you know, dial back, you know, on cut all the taxes to the rich people, reduce taxes for corporations, you know, start changing your trade laws and things so you're not making money on tariffs. And gradually, you know, the money coming into the government is going to drop down to the point where the Democrats are going to be forced to say, oh, okay, all right, we'll do away with Social Security or whatever, you know, because we just don't have the money. That was the theory. And if we simply went back to the way things were taxation-wise before Reagan, and by the way, the country was doing very well back then, very well. In the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, people were rolling along. I mean, our economy was doing very well. If we simply went back to the tax rates, both corporate and personal, and went back to high capital gains tax and estate taxes, you would have an economy that is just fine, and we would easily be able to pay off our debt.
We'll solve a nation now. We'll solve a nation.
I'm not worried about it, Reginald. I think that, you know, I know that this country has the resources to pay. You know, this debt is relatively insignificant compared to the wealth of our nation, to the assets of our nation. I mean, just the, you know, the federal assets are, I think, in the order of $65 trillion. And you know, we've got this incredible GDP. So, you know, we're at roughly 100% of GDP with our debt. You know, we've got roughly a $15 trillion debt, and we have an annual amount of economic activity in our country of around $15 trillion. So we're at 100%. When we ended World War II, we were at 127% of GDP. We owed more than we made every year. And Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower paid that debt off not by cutting one benefit for anybody. In fact, they increased benefits. They paid that debt off by increasing economic activity, stimulating the economy, putting people back to work, and those people paid taxes, and those taxes paid off the debt. And that's what we need to do again, and that's what the president is proposing. Reginald, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Bernie will be with us after the break. Stick around, 15 minutes past the hour. Taking care of business in the U.S. Senate, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us from his office in Burlington, Vermont. Senator Sanders, it's great to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Tom, and I apologize for being a couple of hours late.
It's quite all right. Better late than never.
I have to be on a plane, so that's the way it is.
I understand perfectly. We'll get into calls in maybe in just a minute or two. I'm just curious your kind of opening statement. It need not be as long as usual, but or you can if you wish. But, you know, what's your take on what's going on in D.C. right now?
Well, here's what's going on, and I think most people are paying attention to it. In the next couple of weeks, there's going to be intensive discussion and debate about the so-called fiscal cliff and deficit reduction. And the fight that I am fighting, along with, I think, an increased number of members of Congress, is to say very clearly that we are not going to do deficit reduction on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor people who are already hurting as a result of this terrible Wall Street-caused recession. But rather, we are going to ask the wealthiest people in this country, who are doing phenomenally well, who, as Warren Buffett often reminds us, are paying a lower effective tax rate than many middle-class workers. We're going to ask large corporations, one-fourth of whom pay nothing in taxes. We're going to ask those guys to help us with deficit reduction. And what we are seeing in Washington now is a civil war, in a sense, where the big money interests, you got Wall Street executives coming to Capitol Hill, and these guys are saying, cut Social Security and cut Medicare and cut Medicaid. And by the way, lower the tax rates for large corporations and the wealthy. We have to take them on. We have a middle class which is in decline right now. We have a record number of people who are living in poverty. And when we understand that we have already in the last couple of years cut over $1 trillion in programs for low and moderate income people, when we understand that we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, it is very clear the direction that we have to go to do deficit reduction. And we can do it. If you adopt what the president is talking about, just doing away with Bush's tax breaks for the top 2%, and the Senate in July passed legislation which says we are going to protect the tax breaks for the bottom 98%. And in fact, even the top 2% continue to get some tax breaks on their first $250,000. But we have got to end the excessive tax breaks that have been given to millionaires and billionaires. And you do that, you bring in $1 trillion over a 10-year period. We've already cut over $1 trillion. So what you're really looking at is a problem over a 10-year period of less than $2 trillion. You can deal with that by going after the loopholes that exist that many large corporations, including the energy companies, are benefiting from. You can take a hard look at military spending. We're spending three times what we did in 1997. You do away with the tax havens in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. You bring in a substantial sum of money. We can make Medicare and Medicaid more efficient by having Medicare negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry. If you do all of those things, you can have that $4 trillion over a 10-year period without attacking middle-class people, working families, children, or the elderly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's hope it works out. And because I'm seeing this Fix the Debt group where you've got these, what I think it's 81 CEOs and Judd Gregg and Ed Rendell, and they've raised $60 million, and they've got this very folksy looking website.
And we had the privilege of having Lloyd Blankfein drop in to us in the Congress the other day. Here's a guy, one of the CEOs. He's head of Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs received a $10 billion bailout during the financial collapse, and they received hundreds of billions of dollars in zero-interest loans from the Fed during that period. And this guy, worth a huge amount of money, he comes to Capitol Hill and he says, you got to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And, you know, what we wrote on our website, sanders.senate.gov, and I would urge people to check it out, is this is the face of the class warfare that's been taking place in this country for a whole long period of time. You got these guys on CEO whose greed and illegal behavior caused the recession, which has, by the way, made the deficit even worse. And then after they get their bonuses and after their companies do, you know, very, very well, they're now back on Capitol Hill telling us that we have to attack the elderly, the children, and working families. Well, some of us are going to fight that as hard as we can. But we need the support of the American people, and I hope everybody in this country understands what's at stake.
Yeah, spot on. How much time do we have, Jim? We have just 1 minute. It's not really enough time to get a caller in. Coming, do you expect that there's going to be the so-called fiscal cliff is going to be resolved after the first
year? Hard to say. I surely hope not. I think it would not be good for the country.
You guys have passed the solution in the Senate, haven't you?
We have. Well, we passed the partial solution. What we did pass in the Senate, everybody has got to understand this. We passed legislation that says we are going to continue the tax breaks that the middle class currently gets, that 98% of the American people currently get. We passed that. But what we said, and will continue to say, if I have anything to say about it, is that we are not going to continue the tax breaks for the wealthiest 2%, They are doing very, very well. We have a large deficit. They're going to have to contribute to that deficit, help us deal with that deficit.
Right. But the Republicans in the House, John Boehner is saying, you know, even though the Senate passed this, all the House would do is have a simple majority. I mean, you can't even filibuster
that. That's what we're saying. All right. What we're saying is just pass what the Senate passed. That is $1 trillion over 10 years. We have already, against my vote, I should tell you, cut over $1 trillion already. That's $2.3 trillion already taken care of. All you have left is $1.7 trillion over a 10-year period.
Wow. Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, although given how late it is, maybe we should call it Brewskies with Bernie. We'll be back with Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Tip of the hat to Sean Taylor for that joke. And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. It's an extraordinary news resource. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program. It is our Brunch with Bernie hour, a couple hours late, which is just fine. Senator Sanders on the line with us, answering your questions in our National Town Hall meeting. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, you're still here?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. Let's take a call. Dick in Bridgewater, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
How's it going, Senator? I want to just make this one clear thing here. Tom, I appreciate the fact that you have a show like you do, because a lot of people have no voice.
Thank you.
Senator, you're about the only senator in the country that's actually a United States senator. And I'm saying this, you're a senator of all the people, rich, poor, alike, it doesn't matter, even in what state, because I've called your office, and your staff talks to me as if I live in your state. I'd like to know from you, what do you honestly believe, if it goes over the edge in January, what actually do you think could happen? I mean, we're looking for this, solve the problem, but if nothing happens and they hold tight, what happens next?
Well, the one thing that happens, which concerns me very much and should concern everybody, is that several million people who are receiving unemployment checks will stop getting those checks, and that's going to be a lot of pain out there. But I happen to believe, Dick, that the Republicans are smart enough to know that public opinion is strongly against them, that they got pretty much what they wanted in 2010, they got what they wanted in 2011, and I think this time they understand that the president and the Democratic leadership are going to stand tall, and that some of their wealthy friends and large corporations are going to have to contribute to deficit reduction, and we can't keep going after the middle class and working families. Now, what everybody should understand is the fiscal cliff is not like the debt ceiling. I think people get confused about that. What the debt ceiling was about is the possibility that the United States of America, for the first time in its history, would not pay the bills that it was owed. And that, in fact, could have caused a major ripple throughout the entire financial world. When the wealthiest country on earth does not pay its bills, is a big, big, big deal, nationally and internationally. In this case, what you're talking about is not reaching an agreement, which brings forth sequestration, both for military and non-military spending over a 10-year period, and raises taxes, does away with all of the Bush tax breaks. But none of that stuff in a significant way goes forward immediately. The immediate concern that we have is what happens to people unemployed. So bottom line is, if we go over the so-called cliff and Congress comes to an agreement in January or February, most people will not see much difference, except people who were getting unemployment checks, and that is a serious, serious issue. So my hope is that the Republicans catch on to what the American people want and help us come forward with a fair and responsible deficit reduction package.
Sasha in Kent, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders.
Right.
I am echoing the respect of that first caller for you when you stood up and showed our country this, boys and girls, this is what a filibuster looks like. And then someone walked behind you and stirred up some dust and you had a coughing spell, and I started to think about your humanity and I began to worry for your health. And so I was thinking about your legacy, and I wonder if you can identify any other people that might be coming up after you that would have your integrity in the political system. So far, it feels like you're it.
Well, I thank you very much. Those are very kind and generous remarks. But trust me, there are a number of wonderful people in the United States Senate and in the House as well. And I mean, there are almost too many to name, but a good friend of mine from Ohio who just won a very, very difficult reelection campaign, Sherrod Brown, is doing a terrific job fighting for workers. Sheldon Whitehouse has been a leader on environmental issues. Barbara Boxer on environmental issues. We have some wonderful new people. I mean, this election was not only about reelecting the president. We have some wonderful new senators coming in. I've known Elizabeth Warren for many, many years. I think people are going to be very proud of the work that she does representing not only Massachusetts but America. Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin is Tammy and I just chatted the other day about where we want to go forward together. She's going to be a very strong senator. Mazie Hirono from Hawaii, I think, is going to be really good. So I think you're going to see a lot of bright, younger senators there who are going to be prepared to stand up for working families. Thank you very much, Sasha.
Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Bernie, thanks so much, you guys, for taking my call. So glad you made it in. And on that note, I want to say there's a young man, mid-20s, in the Virginia 12th House of Delegates. His name is Joseph Yost, and I believe he will have the level of integrity that you've shown, Senator. Two issues on John Warner. Yesterday, the vote on S-386, I think it was the Merkley Amendment, to call for a sense of the Senate to bring the troops home from Afghanistan by the end of December 2013, which I was blown away that John McCain actually got up and said, let's not have a recorded vote. But, Bernie, what did go on there? Because I was on the phone calling Warner's office and asking how is he going to vote, and the record says that both he and Webb voted yay, but C-SPAN didn't have the rolling vote tally. So how did that vote go down in the end? And
I
do you think John Warner recognizes the 200?
You mean, are you talking about Mark Warner?
I'm sorry, Mark, yes.
Mark Warner,
oh, yes.
Yeah. John used to be the senator. He retired some years ago.
Yeah.
I don't want to speak for Senator Warner. The Merkley Amendment, we had many amendments yesterday. I believe it won. And what was interesting yesterday is for the first time in a very long time, the Republicans allowed majority rule, 50 votes rather than 60 votes. But what that amendment was about, that I should have mentioned, Jeff Merkley is doing a great job in the Senate. What that is about is to say we have been in Afghanistan longer than in any war in the history of the United States of America, longer than Vietnam. It is time for the Afghan people to take full responsibility for that war. It is time to bring our troops home and start rebuilding America and let the Afghan people rebuild their country.
Okay. Paul in Sebring, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Murray. Can you hear me?
Hey, Paul. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, you're the renewable energy advocate, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, we already have the solar feed-in tariff here in Gainesville, Florida. We're the only place in the United States that has the solar feed-in tariff.
Well, not really. We're doing a little bit of that in Vermont as well, but I'm really great. I mean, Florida is such a sunny state. you guys should be taking big-time advantage of solar, and I'm glad that you do have a feed-in tariff there.
Great. Gray in Nevada City, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, good to hear your voice, sir.
Thank you.
It's my understanding that you have already tried to help out with the bringing back of the WPA.
What we are working on, and Gray, thanks for the question. I think Tom mentioned earlier, and it's not getting the kind of attention that it deserves, that in the president's budget proposal for the so-called deficit fiscal cliff, the president put $50 billion in for rebuilding our infrastructure. Now, that is not as much. We need a lot more than that. So, Gray, we're thinking about a couple of things. Number one, I am absolutely supportive of a massive jobs program, which will include rebuilding our infrastructure, and that's roads, bridges, airports, water systems, wastewater plants, older schools. There's an enormous amount of work to be done in America. In terms of the WPA, which was the Depression-era program, one area that I've been thinking about is how we maybe put young people directly to work in exchange for reducing for giving the very high level of student debt that exists in America. We have $1 trillion of student debt out there. Many of these kids are graduating college. They are deeply in debt. They can't find jobs. And I'm not sure that a WPA program for those young people might not make a whole lot of sense. But bottom line is, we can and must create millions of jobs rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to weatherization and sustainable energy.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our Brunch with Bernie hour here. We're doing it in the third hour of the program today. We're live. It's 45 minutes past the hour, and we'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment. Be sure to check out Bernie's website. He's got a great newsletter, and the website itself is a great news resource. It's at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
So back with more with Senator Bernie Sanders in just a moment. sanders.senate.gov. Be sure to check it out and sign up for his newsletter. It's great.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour and the third hour of our program today. And Lewis in Plainfield, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, fine. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a member of the middle class. I make about $60,000 a year. And I am concerned about a couple statistics. The receipts of the government, $2.3 trillion. About 15% of the GDP, one of the lowest numbers since in the last 50 years. Expenditures, 22% of the GDP, very big margin. What is going to be done to reduce that margin, and what are we going to do about that?
Good question, Lewis. If I understood the first part of the question, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong here, it was a little bit hard hearing, Lewis. He makes the point that revenue as a part of GDP is less than 16% today, which is the lowest that it has been in 60 years. That was his point, wasn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. So Lewis makes a very important point, and that is, in a sense, that because of this Wall Street-caused recession and because of so much unemployment, and real unemployment today is not 7.8%. It's really closer to 15%. That means you got a lot of workers out there who are not paying taxes because they are unemployed. And on the other hand, because they're unemployed, they are receiving unemployment compensation, which costs the federal government money. They're receiving food stamps. They're receiving perhaps other types of help. So when you're in the midst of a major recession, what ends up happening, the government has to spend more to protect the children and the elderly and the sick and the poorest people in this country, and at the same time, less revenue is coming in. And that's the problem that Lewis defined. What we have to do in terms of the revenue picture, Lewis, is what we're working on. We have, right now, the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well. Their effective, i.e., what they actually pay tax rate, is extremely low. That's why Mitt Romney chose not to release his tax returns over a period of years, because clearly what it would have shown is that his effective tax rate, what he was really paying, is lower than a lot of the people in the middle class. So by doing away with Bush's tax breaks for the wealthy and putting it in some other revenue-raising measures, we are going to start bringing in more money to the federal government. In terms of how we cut spending, well, I think there are a number of things that we can do. I think we have to take a hard look at defense spending, in which we are now spending as much as the rest of the world combined. And I think there's some waste in other government agencies that we can take a hard look at. But let's not forget that when you have close to 15% of our people unemployed, unemployed or underemployed, when you have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world, when you have a lot of seniors who are struggling to make ends meet and put food on their table, we can't turn our backs on them. So during a recession, you're going to see more spending and less revenue. We've got to reverse the revenue picture immediately.
Julie in Batavia, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I was just wondering, I've heard you say, and several other people always talking about the Wall Street banksters and how they've gotten away with what they've done is illegal. And I just do not understand why anyone has not been prosecuted for what they've done.
Well, Julie, that is a very, you know, what can I tell you? That is a very important and good question. And, Julie, I mean, I don't want to get you too discouraged, but the simple answer in my view, is that Wall Street is unbelievably powerful. They make enormous campaign contributions to both political parties. They have lobbyists running all over Capitol Hill. So what Wall Street did is drive us into a recession. I have no doubt that it was not just reckless behavior and greedy behavior. I think there was a lot of illegal behavior as well. But I have to tell you, to be very frank with you, Julie, we live in a world, in a nation, where if a kid throws a brick through a window or smokes pot, that kid could get arrested. But if you're a Wall Street billionaire and you do illegal behavior which causes pain for millions of people, nothing much happens to you. And that's the sad reality. And that's why some of us as progressives are working hard to develop a progressive movement, which is prepared to stand up to the power of Wall Street.
Yeah, just to put a punctuation point on that, last week the president of Iceland was asked why his country, which was hit harder than any other country in the world by the recession, has bounced back so well. And he said, we bailed out the middle class and we put the bankers in jail, which is the exact opposite of what we did here. So, Bernie, we have just a minute and a half to wrap up the show.
Just a couple of other thoughts on the week. Yeah. One of the areas, as a member of the Senate Veterans Committee, that I'm going to be paying increased attention to is the issue of how we protect our veterans and how we make the Veterans Administration, which is, in my view, a very good institution, protecting the needs of a whole lot of veterans, how we make it even better. So if there are veterans out there who have ideas about the Veterans Administration, how we can improve health care, we can improve access. One of the concerns that we have, a lot of the men and women coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan in this very rough economy are not finding it easy to get jobs. How do we deal with that issue? People have ideas about programs that are working well, dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. Love to hear about them, because the issue of taking care of our veterans is an issue that I'm going to be paying a whole lot of attention to.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure, Tom. And see you next week.
Yeah, indeed, and for the fabulous work you do in the Senate. And once again, be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You will be very, very impressed, and you'll find a lot of great stuff there. Coming up, next, coming up Monday on the Tom Harbin Program, latest news and information from the weekend to get you ready for the water cooler wars. Plus, we don't really need government workers and regulations to ensure that our food is safe, do we? Oh, my, yes, we do. I'm going to challenge Julie Gunlock at the Independent Women's Forum. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It's not enough to just vote. You got to participate. Tag, you're it. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Harbin. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.